Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In the 2 years since leaving her job as chancellor of Washington, D.C.'s public schools, Michelle Rhee has formed Students First. It's a nationwide organization to push her agenda on education reform in state capitals like Columbus. And she has written a book as well. It's coming out in February, and it's called Radical. Her theories about education reform have earned her both adoration and scorn. A recent PBS Frontline program about her work in the D.C. district exposed both her passion for education and questions about whether that passion actually paid off. Coming up later, we'll hear from the Ohio State Director of Students First to talk about what's going on in the Buckeye State. Joining us now is former Washington, D.C. Public Schools Chancellor Michelle Rhee. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're in town just for one day.
Yes.
Is this to promote the book, or is this more about the reforms that you're interested in promoting at the state capitals?
This is actually about our work with Students First. Students First is a nationwide organization. We have 2 million members across the country. And what we do is we work with our members who are parents and grandparents, teachers, common everyday community members who really care passionately about fixing the public education system in our country. They know it's broken. They know it's not serving all kids well, and they want to do something about it. And so what we are doing is ramping up for this legislative session, hoping that our members can really push the legislature and the governor to ensure that some laws and policies are put in place that we think are going to benefit kids.
Are there state lawmakers in Ohio who are members of Students First?
You know, we have a lot of members of the legislature here who have been very supportive of our efforts to date. In fact, we recently, just last week, put out a 50-state report card that ranks each one of the 50 states across the 37 policies that we outline. And Ohio actually ranked in the top 10. And we feel like in the last 2 years, the state has undertaken a very, very aggressive education reform agenda.
Okay, well, and we'll get to those reasons why Ohio ranks so high when Greg Harris joins us later in the program. He's the Ohio State Director of Students First. Question for our listeners, though. Do you have an idea for education reform? Do you want to know what Michelle Rhee thinks? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Michelle Rhee, the president's going to have a press conference today right around noon to talk about what his plans are for gun laws in the United States and what his response is to the latest tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. One of the tacks that have been taken is to arm people, or the idea of arming people and arming teachers, perhaps, or principals or anybody to stand guard in schools in the United States. I was wondering, what do you think about the idea of armed guards in the schools?
Well, we know from doing this work for a very long time that one of the most foundational and fundamental things that we have to ensure is happening in every school is that the children and the families feel that there is safety and security. You can't learn unless you feel like you are in a safe environment. And so that is of preeminent importance. We are not a gun control organization, so we don't take stances, or make policy recommendations on this. What I would say, though, is that we've got to be careful about jumping to conclusions about, the right answer is to arm a lot of people, or the right answer is to not have, any guns in the schools. Because what we know is that, for example, in Columbine, there were armed guards in the school when that tragedy happened, and it didn't stop that from occurring. And so I'd say that we have to have a very thoughtful conversation in this country about how we can ensure that our schools are as safe as possible, and that people should not just stake out positions and say it's got to be this or it's got to be that. We really have to be looking at things, I think, on an individual case-by-case and district-by-district basis.
In a somewhat related question, from watching the Frontline episode on PBS the other day, it's clear that student behavior takes up a lot of time in the hallways and classrooms of the toughest schools. We already know that. It's clear from, that from watching the program as well. You've talked a lot about the freedom to hire the best and fire the worst teachers. What about moving the chronically disruptive students out of the classrooms, out of the schools?
Well, I think there's a couple pieces to that. And again, a balance needs to be struck. The first thing is that if you look at a lot of the children who are being most disruptive and try to get to the root cause of why, oftentimes they will tell you or the teachers will tell you that it's because they have a tremendous amount of frustration around the fact that they can't keep up, that they don't have the academic skills that they need to be able to know what's going on during that lesson, and that causes them a lot of frustration, and then they act out because of that. I think it's very important for us to know that for those disruptive kids, we cannot abdicate our responsibility to educate them. That's solidly sits within our purview. That said, when you talk to teachers across the country, what they will tell you is that sometimes, you know, upwards of 50, 60, 70% of their time can be spent on just one or two kids who are extraordinarily disruptive, which is really unfair to the other children. And children are children. They will push the envelope as far as they possibly can. And our responsibility is to make sure that they understand that there are rules and that there are consequences for not following those rules. By allowing a disruptive child to stay in the classroom over and over again without any consequences doesn't teach them the right lesson. So there has to be a balance between making sure that children who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing are not disrupting the learning of other children. But if they are going to be put in separate classrooms in the school or environments, it has to be incumbent upon us to ensure that they are getting the quality supports that they need academically so that we ensure that they're growing and that they are gaining the skills that they need.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Michelle Rhee. She's founder and CEO of Students First. She's the former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools. If you have an idea for an education reform and you want to run it by Michelle Rhee, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You were given unprecedented power as the D.C. chancellor. You've criticized the bureaucracy of most big city school districts and have endorsed the idea of the charter school that has more freedom to hire good, as I mentioned earlier, to good teachers and fire bad teachers. But questions remain about the improvement in test results that occurred during your tenure as chancellor. In states where teacher unions are weak, public education tends to be weak as well, and charter schools often are mediocre at best in education, mm-hmm. or maybe don't do any better mm-hmm. than the schools they seek to replace, I guess. Many struggle with the administration of education, lots of accounting problems. Where do you look for validations of your theories on education reform? What tells you, beyond anecdotal examples, that you're headed in the right direction?
So that's all very good questions. I'd say that the important thing to look at within Students First is what our theory of change is. And what we believe very strongly is that there is no shortage of highly effective and innovative educators in our country. We know that all children can learn at very high levels if they are put in the right schooling environment. So the problem, as we see it, is not with the kids or the educators. The problem is that these kids and educators are forced to operate in a crazy bureaucracy where they are actually stymied from being able to do the things that they know are going to result in better outcomes for kids. So if you talk to any principal out there, any district superintendent out there, they will tell you that there are laws and policies in place that prohibit them from being able to hire the best teachers or retain and recognize and reward the most outstanding teachers in their school, from being able to spend the money in the areas that they know are going to result in the best outcomes for kids. And so it's not that I think that charter schools are the answer. In fact, I am a fan of effective charter schools, just as I am a fan of effective traditional public schools. We have to less be looking at whether a school is a private school, a charter school, a traditional public school, and more be looking at it from the lens of, is this an effective school? And so what we advocate for in our policy agenda is the kinds of laws and policies that are going to make schools be able to operate in the kind of environment that where they can be most successful. And what we look to for evidence is, schools that are doing that, who have large populations of kids who may be coming from tough environments, et cetera, but who are still seeing extraordinary results. If you talk to the people in those schools, from the teachers to the principals, they'll tell you that oftentimes they have to skirt around the district or the state laws and rules to make sure that they can do the kinds of things that they know are right for kids.
You said in the Frontline episode that when it comes to turning around a failing urban high school, there aren't very many people in the country who have that skill set. It's a special set of skills. What is it? What is the skill set?
Well, what I was talking about is the fact that you've got so many urban high schools across this country, and some people have dubbed them dropout factories, where the student achievement levels are extraordinarily low, attendance levels are low, graduation rates, I mean, you name it, on almost every measure, the kids are really struggling. And people always want to know, well, what can we do in schools like this? But it is when you have a situation where sometimes for decades you have a culture where that has taken root, where the kids, are not respectful, aren't engaged, don't necessarily care about their education. You've got lots of adults who may be trying hard but aren't used to seeing the kinds of results that they want. You can develop a sense of sort of hopelessness that anything can happen. And the ability to go into that kind of a situation, completely change the culture and expectations is a very, to your point, a very unusual skill set. And what it requires is people who, first of all, have very, very high expectations and a belief that all kids, even kids who, as 9th and 10th graders may not know how to read, believe that all of those kids can be successful. So that's those high expectations. It's the ability to establish a culture where both children and the adults feel incredibly respected and engaged in the process of transforming that school. And then it's about putting in place very clear expectations for everyone around how the school is going to operate, as well as very clear goals for outcomes. You can't expect that in a year's time, a school that has been failing for decades is going to now be one of the top performing schools in the country. But what you can expect is that over time, you can set very clear benchmarks about the kind of improvements that we want to see in things like attendance rates, decreases in suspensions and fights that are going on, and then ultimately increases in student achievement levels.
My guest is Michelle Rhee, the founder and CEO of Students First. She's the former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools. We'll return to our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and it's 34 degrees. Expect sunshine today and a high near 41. Clear skies for tonight, a low of 25 degrees. More sunshine Saturday with a high of 52. Support comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the spirit of Columbus, the name of the plane that Jerry Mock flew into history almost 50 years ago. The spirit of Columbus is also about civic pride, accomplishment, and helping others. More about the spirit of Columbus is at columbusfoundation.org. And support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid annually. Nationally ranked academics and a 92% job placement rate are hallmarks of an ONU education. Explore Pharmacy Day is March 16th. ONU.edu. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm talking this hour with Michelle Rhee, the founder and CEO of Students First. She's also the former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools. She's a well-known education reform activist in the United States. If you have an idea for an educational reform, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to some of that in a second. I just wanted to first ask you, Michelle, when you took over the D.C. school district, you met one-on-one with every principal in the district and asked them what they could guarantee going forward regarding test scores. What about relying on tests to tell what about the idea of relying on tests to tell the story of success? Are you confident that those are the best indicators of success or failure? Because the idea of asking for a guarantee was repeated.
So one of the things that I think it's important to say is that when I met with those principals one-on-one, the goals that we set were around academic achievement as measured by test scores, but some of them had to do with other things like attendance. Ensuring that you were going to retain your most highly effective teachers, right? So there were multiple facets to the kinds of goals that we were setting every day. In terms of growth in academic achievement as being part of, a major part, in fact, of the kinds of goals that we were setting for schools, I think it was incredibly important because we had entered a school district where 8% of the eighth graders in the city schools were on grade level in mathematics, 8%. And yet, when I looked at the performance evaluations of the adults in the system at the same time, 98% of them were being rated as doing an excellent job. How can you have that kind of a dynamic where all the adults are running around thinking, I'm doing great work, and yet the results that we were seeing for kids were so low? So we wanted to align some of those things and make sure that the adults knew that they were going to be held accountable for the academic achievement growth of their children. There's a balance that needs to be struck, though. I am very much against the idea of saying that the test scores are all that matter. And I do not think that that should be the way that teachers are evaluated. I don't believe that that's the way schools should be evaluated at all, because the bottom line is that if you have an over-reliance on tests, then a culture can develop where people are saying, well, that's all that matters, when in fact we know that that the kids who learn the most are not the kids in the classrooms of teachers who are teaching to the test, but rather the children who are in the classroom of teachers who are really teaching a broad-based curriculum.
And the reliance on the test, some people have said that the importance of the tests and the importance they've attained have driven some teachers and administrators around the country, not just in Washington, D.C., but there's a lot of suspicion. Atlanta had a big problem with cheating on the tests, not by the kids, but by the teachers. That drives them. They want to please their bosses. They don't want to get fired. They want to get that bonus that might be out there, and it drives them to do things like that.
So is it something that we should be aware of? Absolutely. Should measures be put in place to ensure that we have test security? Absolutely. But I am a big believer in teachers, and I very, very strongly believe that the vast majority of educators in this country would never, ever compromise their personal or professional integrity and cheat on a test, because they know that by doing so, they're cheating kids. And teachers, for the most part, I mean, the vast majority of teachers are in this profession being underpaid and underappreciated because they care about children. And so they're not going to say, well, because I might get some kind of a recognition, I'm going to do this. Most teachers are not going to do that at all. And in fact, if we put the right consequences in place, and we did this in Washington, D.C., when we investigated and found evidence or circumstances where people were cheating, they were dismissed from the system. So the bottom line was that if you were scared of being fired or terminated, then the last thing that you would do is cheat on a test, because that would guarantee that you wouldn't be there in the system any longer.
Nadine in Columbus, you're on the air with Michelle Rhee. Welcome, Nadine.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call, Michelle. Thank you for being such a tireless and vocal advocate of public education in this country. I really appreciate your effort.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, I'm calling from a perspective of a mom whose only child is about to enter public school next fall as a kindergartner. And I see the early school start times, and I guess this goes to the crazy bureaucracy that you used, that term you used earlier. Have you looked at or evaluated very early start times that public education seems to feel they need to start school so early in the morning, when the research seems to indicate that children, especially adolescent children's internal clocks, don't really get going till later in the day? And the impact that that has on education has been found to be significant. Can you speak to that and whether you've seen any schools evaluate that and change their practices?
Well, what I would say is that not all schools are the same or have the same attitude towards things. And but the problems that you're talking about is exactly why I started the Students First organization. And we named it Students First for a particular reason, because to your point, so many of the policies that are put in place that govern how schools and school districts are run are put in place for the adults. Right? For the system. Well, it'll be better for the system if we run the buses at certain times and we end at certain times, et cetera, as opposed to thinking about things from the perspective of what is going to serve our children the best. To be honest with you, I don't think there's any research out there that says, you know, the best time to start school for every kid is at 8:15 versus 7:45. What we advocate for is flexibility, that every school ought to be able to make those kinds of decisions on their own, that they ought to be able to show that, you know, we found that if we are in school from this time to this time, that we're going to get the best results. And here's how we're going to show our progress. And if you meet those, then you have the flexibility to make those kinds of decisions.
Thanks, Nadine, for your call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care. Deborah in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Is that me, Deborah?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I would like to say that I think that things have gotten to the point where there needs to be a total emphasis on ethics before anything else. They should be tested and taught and tested for, you know, what they can handle at the lower levels all the way through college and beyond.
Are you talking about teachers or students?
Well, at this point, at my age and at this point, it's probably both, but I just think that it has to start somewhere. So,
yeah.
you know, the ethics is very, very important. I think
okay.
There's some sort of saying that if, you know, education in the wrong hands can be worse than you probably know this.
Well, like, this gets into, Michelle Reed, the whole idea of values.
Yeah.
And that's
absolutely
always a hot topic.
Absolutely. You know, I used to actually teach in Baltimore.
Well, this is Baltimore,
I'm sorry,
Ohio.
Baltimore. Well,
yep.
Baltimore. I used to teach in Baltimore, Maryland. You know, when I taught some 20-odd years ago, teaching and education was very different. You know, we thought, well, if kids come in and we teach them reading and math skills, you know, then we've done our job. And today, education is very, very different. A lot of kids are coming to school every day without what we used to call home training that we used to expect. And that means that kids are coming to school every day not having sort of the skills from home about work ethic and discipline and time management and that sort of thing. And so for better or worse, that has fallen in large part on the schools to be able to do those things as well. And I think it is incredibly important for those kinds of values to be upheld, to be taught, to be reinforced in the school so that our kids know that you can't expect to do well unless you put the time in, you pay attention, you do your homework, you're listening to your teacher. Those things for many of our kids are not givens anymore, and they need to be. So those kinds of values have to be instilled in our kids through our schooling system as well.
Deborah, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Oh, Deborah, I want to move on.
I didn't mean that sort of thing specifically. I'm talking about being able to tell if they have any sort of trying to teach them and then test them on whether they have any sort of basic feeling about the difference between right and wrong and how people should treat each other and things like that.
Okay.
Well, certainly anything that you teach in school, we ought to be able to have a way to measure whether or not we're doing it effectively. And that would certainly encompass any kinds of teaching about social skills or ethics as well.
Thank you, Deborah, for the call. We appreciate it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest once again is Michelle Reed, former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools and founder and CEO of Students First. We're asking our listeners for some ideas about education reforms they think might work. And we could run by Michelle Reed, 614-292-8513. You can go to our Facebook page as well, as did Ben. He writes, well, if it was up to me, I would reform the types of classes offered to middle and high school students. I would bring back home education, home ec, I would bring back home education, home ec, woodworking class, and even auto shop classes. That way we bring everyday knowledge to our future generations, such as balancing finances, minor car repairs, how to fix a button, and yes, even to cook. This goes for both young men and women alike. Michelle, a lot of those classes that Ben mentioned are expensive classes to teach, for one thing, but they are basic everyday skills that a lot of kids lack.
Well, what I think we need is a balance. We certainly need some of the everyday skills. Take financial literacy, for example. The new generation of Americans who are growing up today have extraordinary access to credit cards, et cetera. And unless they understand what it means when you are racking up that credit card bill and how much you are being charged in compound interest, it can lead to catastrophic results in the long term. So ensuring that our kids have basic skills like financial literacy are extraordinarily important. You know, back in the day, what was called vocational education, things like woodworking and auto shop, et cetera, were meant to be able to prepare students with real life skills that would allow them to get a job. Now, the world is very different today than it was 50 years ago. And the kinds of jobs and that people need to get to be able to support a family of four, well, the vast majority of those now require some level of higher education. So the kinds of what we now call career and technical education, which used to be called vocational education, have to be in different fields. We have to look at the burgeoning fields of things like biotech or clean and green tech, and potentially add some of those kinds of classes into schools, as opposed to sort of hearkening back to the days of yore and say, okay, we've got to do woodworking. I don't know how many, you know, high-paying jobs in woodworking there are out there. Maybe carpentry sort of more generally.
On the other hand, woodworking, the arts, that sort of thing, they work different parts of the brain. Woodworking can help you learn and understand geometry better. In a very fundamental, people, they always say, well, what does this matter? Well, this is how you build something, and you need to have some fundamental knowledge to do that.
Sure. It's a real-life application, and we should always, as educators, be looking for real-life applications of the somewhat abstract concepts that we're teaching kids. But I also think that we have a responsibility to make sure that in building the skills of kids, that we are preparing them for the jobs of tomorrow.
Email from John. It kind of follows up on what our previous caller was asking about values and ethics and so forth. He says, where does parent responsibility fit into education? It seems to me that politicians have picked up the fact that there are far more parents of poorly performing students than there are teachers. So they support those ideas which demonize teachers and unjustly absolve parents of their responsibilities. How many of those 92% of children who are failing in math in eighth grade came to kindergarten able to count to 10 and recognize their numbers?
So, I mean, I think this has to be seen as a community effort. I mean, you know, people talk a lot about the scapegoating of teachers or the demonizing of teachers. You know, I don't see it that way at all. I see teachers not as the problem of the issue at all. I see them as the solution. If you look at research across this country, you will see that of all of the in-school factors that exist, teacher quality is the number one factor that positively impact student achievement levels. So we should aspire to make sure that there is a high-quality teacher in front of every child every single day. Can we absolve parents of their responsibility in this? Absolutely not. The research also shows that when parents are really engaged in their students' education, that the achievement levels are higher. So we should do everything that we can as a system to ensure that we are creating the kind of environment where parents are welcome, where their involvement is really encouraged. But I will say this, that we don't choose who our parents are. And what I want to make sure that we communicate is that there are some kids who are in an unfortunate situation where their parents are not involved. They're not engaged. And there's not a lot that the school or anybody can do about that. And the question that we have to ask ourselves as a society is, are we going to abdicate our responsibility to educate that child because of something that they had absolutely no control over, which is who their parents are and what their parents choose to do or not do? I would say the answer to that has to be no. We are the greatest country in the world for a particular reason, because we believe that any child, regardless of the color of their skin or the circumstance of their birth, can live the American dream and be successful. Not it's not dependent on who your parents are and how involved they are. It's because we have a system in place, a social system in place with high-quality public schools that ensure that every kid can be successful.
But the whole point of our conversation today is the fact that that system doesn't really exist.
It doesn't exist
yet.
There
are lots of very low-performing public schools. They tend to be in the large, the inner cities, the big city school districts. There are patterns across the board that that's a fantasy. It doesn't really exist. We're not the greatest country in the world because of that.
Well, we are at serious risk of losing that title of being the best country in the world, because we used to be the country that everybody wanted to come to because of that equity and equality, because you could come to this country and you didn't have to be the son or daughter of aristocrats to be able to be successful, right? You could be just a hardworking, low-income person, but if you did the right thing, then you could be incredibly successful. And right now in this country, we are facing a circumstance where the color of a child's skin and the zip code that they live in really do dictate their educational outcomes, because for the most part, the likelihood that they will attend a failing school is much higher if you are a low-income child, and then therefore you're not going to get the skills and knowledge that you need. That's what makes this education reform movement so urgent in my mind. We have to fix our public school system. We have to ensure that every kid is in a high-quality school, because it's the only way that we're going to fulfill our promise to the next generation of Americans that you can live the American dream.
You hit the national limelight when the then Washington, D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty appointed you chancellor of public instruction at the D.C. School District. What do you think about the trend of mayors, few of whom come from a career in education, what do you think about the trend of them taking over big city school districts? They've tried it in Cleveland. There's been very, very little change. The mayor in Columbus isn't trying to take over the district. On the contrary, he has said pointedly that he doesn't want to, but he's appointed a commission to talk about and maybe come up with some ideas for change. What about that?
So I have firsthand experience with this, not just because my boss used to be the mayor in D.C. in a mayoral control school district, but also because my husband is a mayor. My husband is the mayor of Sacramento, California. He came to that from being in the NBA. So he wasn't an educator by trade per se. But one of the things that he realized very quickly, and he has worked with the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National Conference of Black Mayors to educate mayors more about, is the fact that the ultimate health and vitality of any city is going to be based on the quality of the public education system. You cannot talk Fortune 500 companies into coming into your city unless they feel like their employees are going to have high-quality schools to send their kids to, unless they feel like they're going to have a highly skilled workforce to hire from. So schools really sit at the crux of any city, and I think more and more mayors are beginning to realize and understand that. And instead of saying, oh, well, the schools, that's not my responsibility, that's the superintendent, more mayors are getting involved in a variety of ways in the quality of schools. And I think that's a very, very positive trend.
Uma in Dublin, you're on the air. You want to talk about sports in schools.
Sure. Thank you so much for taking my call. Michelle, I really admire you. And
thank
I'm
you.
An involved parent in the school district as well. But one thing I noticed is, like, when the kids are in the elementary school, it would be great if they could have, like, you know, study more. Like, I remember my son going through the elementary, just reading about pilgrims for 4 years. There are so many things in the world that he could have learned at that age. The teachers and the system and the curriculum has to be designed in such a way that you give more to them when they are very young. And so that trend keeps continuing in the middle school and high school. If you suddenly put so much pressure on the kids when they come to high school, it's too late. And also, you know, another thing is, you know, sports should be really abandoned from the school itself.
Okay. There's a big emphasis on sports, particularly in Ohio, particularly in Columbus, particularly at Ohio State University.
Well, being from the Buckeye State myself, being an Ohio girl, I understand that. I think that the issue that this mom was talking about is hopefully in large part going to be addressed by the adoption of the Common Core standards. To date, we've had a system where every state adopts their standards, and then every single district has a different curriculum to address those standards, and then you've got lots of different standards and lots of different curricula across the country. Right now, the Obama administration has been moving in the direction of developing a set of Common Core standards, which means that we have a set of national standards, which are internationally benchmarked. And the reason why that's important is because the kids who are growing up in Dublin today are not going to be competing for jobs against the kids in Columbus or in Sacramento or Memphis. They're going to be competing for jobs against the kids in Singapore and China and South Korea. And so we have to have internationally benchmarked standards, and that's the direction that we are moving in. And hopefully what you'll see as a result of that is that you will have a much more rigorous set of standards at every grade level, starting from the lowest grades.
Thank you, Uma, for that call. My guest is Michelle Rhee. She's founder and CEO of Students First. She's also the former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools. Coming up after the break, Greg Harris, he's the Ohio State Director of Students First. We'll focus a little bit more on Ohio when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This radio signal goes out to all Americans who have survived the coming of the sequester. If you have any supplies to share, light a beacon near your camp to alert other bands of survivors. But watch for the packs of feral, furloughed federal employees. I'm Peter Sagal. We'll be overstating threats of all kinds on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
And Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with a discussion of the best books for spring reading. Join us for All Sides Weekend with host Christopher Purdy from 11 till noon. 34 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine warming up to a high of 41 today. Clear skies tonight, a low of 25, mostly sunny and a high of 52 on Saturday. And clouds with a chance of rain on Sunday, but warm, a high of 55. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. And All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We've been talking with former Chancellor of the Washington, D.C. Public Schools, Michelle Rhee. She's still with us. Joining us now is Greg Harris. He's the Ohio State Director of Students First. It's an organization launched by Michelle Rhee 2 years ago to put forth and lobby for a host of education reform policies across the country. Welcome to the show, Greg Harris.
Thank you.
I read that Students First has helped pass more than 70 education policies in 17 states, and I was wondering if you could be specific about a couple of those policies if they've in Ohio that have passed.
Yeah, I mean, we had a major policy passed last session, which is a new way of assessing and grading report cards. I mean, grading schools with report cards, A to F, and we see this as an advantage in many ways, especially as a parent empowerment tool. Our former way of grading schools used terms that were sort of anomalous. They didn't really have a connection to everyday.
Now they went to the ABCD thing?
Yeah, which, you know, not
we
necessarily.
We all get that.
It's not perfect, but everyone who's been to school knows what an A is, knows what an F is, and everything in between. We want parents to be empowered to be able to make good choices about their children's education. And this is part and parcel to that, of having really clear information about, you know, the school performance and allowing them to make choices accordingly.
In Ohio, we're awaiting the results of a statewide audit of all the districts regarding the suspected alterations of student records to improve the district's overall rating. An investigation by the Columbus Dispatch found that officials in Columbus City Schools altered millions of records over the years to make the schools appear that their students were performing better on state standardized tests. And this has sent shockwaves across the state. People aren't sure whether it's called an A or whether it's called achieving, you know, high or achieving low. They're not sure whether they can trust what they're getting when it comes to these kinds of report cards. Michelle Reed?
Well, I would say that's absolutely right, and that's one of the biggest challenges when states and bureaucrats are putting together an accountability system. I spent a lot of my time in California, and we have something called the API, and is you have a score, and you got to get to 800, and you have a score of 684 for your school, and most parents look at that and say, I have absolutely no idea what that
means.
And
now we wonder if it's even true,
even if it's real,
whatever it
right.
means.
And so the whole philosophy that we have at Students First is one that parents deserve access to real and meaningful information about the quality of the schools and the quality of education that their kids are getting. And that should be in an easily understandable and digestible format. So they don't have to have a PhD in education policy to be able to figure it out. And, you know, it's their taxpayer dollars that are being spent to run the public schools every day. So it absolutely should be the responsibility of the school districts and the State Department of Education to make sure that parents are getting that accurate and easy to understand information.
David in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. And I do appreciate Ms. Yee's work. My comment is dump the money on early childhood. And that includes educating parents how to raise their kids. We need a license to drive, but any fool can raise a kid.
Or not.
Without education, early childhood is where the brain grows the most. Come on. We've known this for decades, for
okay.
generations.
Michelle,
let's do it right.
Michelle Ree?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting, if you look over the last 20 to 30 years in this country, you have a very strong voice that has always said, what we need in order to fix the schools is more money. Right, that's a drumbeat that you hear almost every year at the school district at the state level. But when you actually look at the data, what it shows is that over the last two decades in this nation, we have more than doubled, almost tripled the amount of money that we are spending per child on public education. And that's controlling for inflation. And yet the results have remained stagnant. And part of the reason for that is because we don't, there's not a lot of transparency around where the dollars are going. And so what we are hoping Ohio will adopt is a fiscal transparency law where you have to say, every school district, every school has to say, here was our total budget, and here's what we spent on things, and here's what our outcomes are. Because then we'll be able to see, okay, if early childhood is the kind of investment that is going to see huge gains in student achievement, then there's going to be more pressure on districts to say, okay, you ought to be putting your money towards these things that we know really move student achievement, as opposed to those things that aren't producing any results.
And let me just say, in sort of defense of parents, I mean, there are certainly bad parents, rich or poor. I mean, they exist. But by and large, in working in the areas that are severely economically disadvantaged, they want the best choices for their kids. They want the best options for their kids. They'll climb mountains to get to them. And we've seen this all over the country, including in Ohio.
David, thanks a lot for your call. Right. Take care.
Good.
Joe in Akron, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, thank you, Ann. I also want to thank Ms. Reed. I watched the show on her, and I think she's just awesome.
Thank you.
What my comment is about, I've told him before, about the difference, the disparity between, say, a school system up in Hudson versus the inner city schools. And I do agree about the parenting, and I think there needs to be some responsibility held to the parents because they have an obligation to be they have to protect their child. But I just think that why is it so many of the kids that are in the rich areas they come out okay? They're not in our prisons by the time they're 25. But the inner city, the poor kids are just disproportionately by – leaps and bounds that don't succeed. And I think society has part blame for that. And I think the state of Ohio, we fund our system by local property taxes. So rich people can afford, and they vote for levy after levy, where the poor people, it's not that they don't want to spend money on their children, they can't.
Okay. Well, you know, State Budget Director Tim Keene said in a recent interview that they're going to try to take into account the different types of students that districts educate, and that some of the different challenges that districts have in educating the particular mix of student types that they have. And I think the point that Joe's making on top of all of that, say you take an inner city school district where they're spending a couple million dollars a year, not on early childhood education, but on security, on metal detectors, on things that have absolutely no relevance in a nice suburban school.
Well, in a few weeks, the governor will introduce his budget, and with that, his new model for school funding. And what we are hoping to see is exactly what we're talking about, which is a weighted student formula, which will take this into account. Some kids are more expensive to educate, and we have to take into account the fact that kids are coming to school every day with, you know, various challenges, and we should ensure that our resources are being allocated accordingly. And so we're very hopeful that we'll see some nod to that when the new system and model is introduced.
Have you met with the governor or his people?
You know, we have, I believe Greg has talked to a number of the folks who are involved in that process. We came, actually, Students First came not too long ago and testified in front of the legislature on this issue to lay out what we believed the best finance system for school funding would look like. And so hopefully, you know, they listened and they're taking some of that into account.
Yeah, we called for weighted funding, and we also called for giving schools a lot more flexibility to reach, you know, desired outcomes. You know, there are major issues. Your station has reported very well on recent studies that came out that in Columbus, the kids kindergarten through third grade are not even achieving basic levels of reading.
The third grade guarantee,
But they can't even read the cover of a book, and you know, that's a real problem. Something's going on during the school day where half the kids are not attaining basic proficiency in literacy. So we can develop a smart system that accounts for that, policies that make, you know, teachers accountable for that, but ensures that these students are achieving some level of academic growth. But again, in some cases, it could require more money. Your reading specialists, more TAs. We have to have a formula that accounts for that.
It sounds like a redistribution of wealth. And it's just going to force the higher wealth districts to continue to ask for more and more levies because they want to be competitive and they want to always be better.
Well, I think that what it requires is just a fundamental step back of how, if we know that education is the most important thing that we could focus on for the long-term economic viability of the state, then we have to invest in that, and we have to invest in it appropriately. And I don't think that any of our schools should be in a position where they're saying we don't have enough money to do X, Y, and Z. But the only way that we're going to get at understanding whether schools do have an appropriate amount of money is having that transparency, is understanding what are those dollars being spent on, what is the return on investment that we are getting in those areas. And if the school district is spending money on things that aren't, isn't resulting in good outcomes for kids, then we have to stop that spending. I can tell you from running the school district in the country that was sort of the poster child for why more money isn't going to fix the system, right? We were spending more money per child in Washington, D.C. than almost any other jurisdiction in the entire nation, and our results were at the rock bottom. We were spending $1 billion on education in the city, a relatively small city. Of that $1 billion, only $403 million of it were going into the schools, into the classrooms, into the schools. That means the majority of the money was being spent on this incredibly bloated bureaucracy, on things that weren't going to have an impact day-to-day on kids. That's the kind of look that we have to have, is where is the money going, and how can we push more of that money down to the classroom?
Thank you, Joe. We appreciate your call. Alan in Springfield, you're on the air. Welcome, Alan.
My sister taught in the Dayton school system year-round school, and she loved it because she didn't have to retrain the kids in September when they came back to school from being 4 months, 3 months off. What's your opinion of year-round school versus our typical system of Evan Summers off.
So, you know, when we are talking about how to transform the education of our kids, we have to utilize every resource at our disposal. And time is one of the most important resources that people often are overlooking. If our kids are behind and we want them to catch up, then to think that that can happen within the confines of the regular school day and school year is very naive. If you look at some of the highest performing schools, whether they're traditional public schools, public charter schools, or private schools across this country, they will tell you that their kids are in class more often than the average kid is. And so I think we should absolutely be looking at longer school days, longer school years, and moving away from the agrarian calendar that drove the summers off to begin with. We know a lot about summer learning loss now. We know it's not good. We know it disproportionately negatively impacts the lower income kids who don't have the kinds of summer opportunities that other children do. And so we ought to be putting in place policies that account for that.
It's an interesting combination of cultures. We have the agrarian calendar dictating the 9 months a year, and then we have the Industrial Revolution culture affecting the school bells and that sort of thing, and the very regimented 40 minutes, 45 minutes, or 50 minutes, or whatever it is. And do you see any of that in the long run ever changing and on any kind of large scale?
We believe that it absolutely has to change. The most important thing in educating all kids well is differentiation. Because when you walk into a classroom, you're going to be facing 26 kids, and all of them are at slightly different levels and learn in different ways, and we've got to differentiate. And you know, the bottom line is that for some kids, you know, having a few extra minutes of math is really going to be the answer, and other kids, you know, a shorter amount of time. And so I think that what we are seeing across the country right now with more of the digital learning platforms and some of the online efforts that you are seeing have the ability to differentiate and provide support for kids at different levels, depending on kind of what their interests are, where their skill levels are, et cetera, that are really promising looking forward.
Alan, thanks for your call. We talked earlier, and we're pretty much out of time, Greg Harris, but if you could, in just about 30 seconds, tell us what put Ohio in the top 10 nationally in terms of how you rate schools?
Ohio's on a really positive trajectory. I mean, it started even with one of 10 races at the top states. You know, a competition where we were awarded by the Obama administration significant funds that changed some of our practices. We're a Common Core state. And now we're starting to do things from aligning a teacher assessment to student outcomes, to really ramping up charter quality and accountability. That'll really help in the move education in the right direction. We have a ways to go, but we're ahead of a lot of states, and we're going to keep going.
Thanks for joining us today, Greg.
Thank you.
Greg Harris, he's the Ohio State Director of Students First. And also Michelle Rhee, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Michelle Rhee is the founder and CEO of Students First and former chancellor of Washington, D.C. Public Schools. You can learn more about her on the Frontline episode, and you can get that online. You can go to a link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.